So we finished there yesterday, and today we're starting at verse 20, and from verse 20 to 35, Nagarjuna once again replies to his opponent. He says, "If all this was non-empty, as is your view, there would be no arising and ceasing, then the Four Noble Truths would become non-existent." So the opponent's view was based on the inherent existence of phenomena. That is, that they ultimately did not exist. In other words, they were non-empty. However, if this were so, there would be no arising and ceasing, and consequently, the Four Noble Truths would be non-existent. If everything was non-empty, there would be no arising and ceasing. Otherwise, he would have reified phenomena, existence. They couldn't change. So in verse 21, "If it is not dependently arisen, how could suffering come to be?"
Sorry. Can I just ask a question? We keep using this word reified.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it means.
It means make it real.
Right.
You know, to make something...
Turn something into a thing.
Right.
Into a fixed object.
Yeah.
"If it is not dependently arisen, how could suffering come to be? Suffering has been taught to be impermanent, and so cannot come from its own essence." So Nagarjuna has turned the tables on his opponent. When he denied emptiness, he denied dependent origination, and consequently impermanence. But since suffering is impermanent, then he himself was denying the existence of suffering. Suffering can't come from its own essence. So that's the First Noble Truth, the existence of suffering. So he's saying in 21, "If it is not dependently arisen, how could suffering come to be? Suffering has been taught to be impermanent, and so cannot come from its own essence." So the tables are turned with that on the opponent. When he denied emptiness, he denied dependent origination. In other words, that everything is continually arising in dependence and conditions. So he was consequently suggesting that everything was, you know, he was denying impermanence. But since suffering is impermanent, then he himself was denying the existence of suffering. He was saying it was something permanent. And if it was permanent, well, if everything was permanent, suffering couldn't come into existence. Suffering can't come from its own essence. If suffering was permanent, as he was suggesting, that it was non-empty, then it's just impossible that it could come from its own essence, from its own permanence.
It's sort of impossible to imagine a world where everything is permanent, isn't it? It doesn't work.
Well, there's no life.
On a completely mechanical level, it just can't work.
That's right.
So you can't think about whether suffering would be present in that, because
The
whole premise is completely upside down.
Yeah. So verse 22, "If something comes from its own essence, how could it ever be arisen? It follows that if one denies emptiness, there can be no arising, no arising of suffering." As we said, suffering cannot arise from its own permanent essence. So it follows that if emptiness is denied, there can be no arising of suffering. Again, we're back to the opponent saying there's no, you know, the empty means non-existence. So he is actually giving existence of phenomena, permanent existence. So if they've got that, they can't change. So So if suffering was permanent, it couldn't arise. It couldn't arise from its own essence. So there could be no cause of suffering. If suffering had an essence, its cessation would not exist. So if an essence is positive, one denies cessation. If it has an essence, it's fixed, its cessation would not exist. So if an essence is positive, one denies cessation. So he's turning the tables on his opponent in every statement he's making now.
He's kind of having a play on just the very simple conditionality formula, really, isn't he? That's what he's looking at. He's running forwards and backwards with things arising dependence on conditions, but what if things arise in dependence on themselves?
Yeah.
Or not even independence on things, just arise of themselves and they're not dependent on any other cause.
This is also the trouble that the Protestants got into. Do you remember the elect? In one stage of Protestantism, there's a lovely book called The Confessions of a Justified Sinner, and by James Hogg. And in that, he's really working with the sense of being a part of the elect, and that essentially already he is one of the elect who's going to heaven anyway. So actually, there's nothing he can do to change that. And nothing that he does will change that. And it's just that running backwards and forwards in the novel about that that position is that, you know, it can't be changed. And so, and that the elect are somehow different from everybody else. But he gets, you know, gets to run rampant with sin because, you know, he's already there.
Yes.
And there's really no difference. So
yeah.
It's quite fun watching it.
So if suffering had an essence, its cessation would not exist. So if an essence is posited, one denies cessation. So inherently existent things can't cease. Empty things can. So that's the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. If the path had an essence, cultivation would not be appropriate. If this path is indeed cultivated, it cannot have an essence. So if everything was fixed, the path couldn't be cultivated because it was arising. Cultivation of the path is only possible if suffering is impermanent. If it had an essence, it cannot change and cannot be cultivated. The path couldn't be cultivated unless there was change.
I think it's this area that I'm finding really, really interesting at the moment, because it's like the whole perfection of wisdom takes you on this sort of journey out into thinking about the nature of existence, the nature of being, and then it's like it just suddenly brings you straight back into mainstream traditional basic Buddhism.
Mm.
And it's like that's what I'm finding quite engaging at the moment, quite interesting.
Yeah.
It's just trying to work out what that means,
yeah.
You know, how I make something of that.
Yes, the garden. This brings it right.
It's just straight back in there.
Into us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if suffering, arising and ceasing are non-existence, by what path could one seek to obtain the cessation of suffering? So this is returning to the opponent's view that things cannot exist if they are empty, and therefore there could be no path. What path could one obtain the cessation of suffering? And the path is a path to awakening. Its cultivation is only possible if suffering is impermanent. The Guardian is making it clear that it's only in terms of emptiness that the path and its cultivation make any kind of sense at all. And that's the fourth noble truth. If non-understanding comes to be through its own essence, how will understanding arise? Isn't essence stable? So if non-understanding, in other words, ignorance, is real according to the opponent and has an essence, since essence is unchanging, how could we ever not be ignorant? How could we ever have any understanding? In the same way, the activities of relinquishing, realizing, and meditating, and the four fruits would not be possible. For an essentialist, since the fruits, through their essence, are already unrealized, in what way could one attain them? So in the same way if ignorance had an essence, it would be real. How then could other practice and the fruits of it be possible? It's just reinforcing all the time that the opponent's view of things being non-empty means that they're fixed and they can't change. There's nothing you can do if you reify.
The one thing I mean plainly is putting the word love in there.
And where about you want to put
everywhere,
love?
You know,
everywhere.
Just the concept of love and putting it into this. You know? It's harder to escape love. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you go back to the Heart Sutra again, Avalokiteshvara is looking down with compassion,
mm-hmm.
and he is expressing Pratityasamutpada all the time,
mm-hmm.
but he's seeing the suffering of sentient beings because they are, in effect, taking the view of the opponent who want to make things permanent, who want to see things as being permanent. That's the cause of suffering in the first way that we're grasping at.
Mm-hmm.
But the love or the compassion that's coming in
mm-hmm.
is showing in the opening of the Heart Sutra.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For an essentialist, since the fruits through their essence are already unrealized, in what way could one attain them? So in the same way, if ignorance had an essence, it would be real. How then could all our practice and the fruits of practice be possible? Without the fruits, there are no attainers of the fruits or enterers. From this it follows that the eight kinds of persons do not exist. If these don't exist, there is no spiritual community. So, if there's no path, no fruits, then there can be no sangha. From the non-existence of the noble truths would follow the non-existence of the true doctrine. If there is no doctrine and no spiritual community, how could a Buddha arise? So if the noble truths are non-existent, it follows that there's no doctrine of dependent arising. If no true doctrine, no sangha, then how could a Buddha arise? He's just taking it step by step. This is what the opponent went through right at the beginning, you know, saying that these couldn't exist because of his doctrine of emptiness, that he was interpreting it as nothing exists. But Nagarjuna is just turning the tables on him completely and say that it's his view that is non-existence. For you it would follow that a Buddha arises independently of enlightenment, and for you enlightenment would arise independent of a Buddha. For you, one who through his essence was unenlightened, even by practicing the path to enlightenment, could not achieve enlightenment. So here the opponent's view is that the phenomenal world is non-empty, and hence all things have an essence. Thus for him, a Buddha arises independent of enlightenment and vice versa. Everything's non-empty, it's fixed. If a Buddha is in existence, can't go out of existence. If it's not in existence, it can't come into existence. And the same, you would say the same for enlightenment.
That's what I'm about to run through here. I haven't got any. It's just like, what about the transcendental principle? Or, do you know what I mean, in terms of Buddhahood, the principle of Buddhahood? And I suppose I kind of like... I don't know if I've been mishearing old teachings of the Buddha's enlightenment arose on dependence upon conditions, but Buddhahood as a principle is eternal. And is that the Tathagatagarbha?
No, I think that is sort of basic Buddhism, that, you know, the Dharma is something eternal. Well, eternal, that it's always there, but it's forgotten and lost, and then it's rediscovered and so on.
How does that sit then?
The Pratitya Samuppada is always there. The conditioned arising is always present, because conditioned arising continues. It's not that it is a thing, but it continues, doesn't it?
How do you not make a thing process as opposed to...
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a label that we apply to an ongoing unfolding process, isn't it? But it's within that ongoing unfolding process that the potential for Buddha exists. So in that sense, the Buddha is eternal.
Or maybe it's the difference between a principle and a thing.
And all that principles, everything else, are labels. Remember the emptiness of emptiness.
Okay, I'm having a slight problem here with this eternal aspect of Buddha. And I know that's kind of what you've all been trying to explain, but it still left me confused. If it's a dependently arisen phenomenon, surely it will also respond to... It will. It's part of the flow, so it will change, which instantly stops it being eternal. In my head,
depends how you define eternal. You know, I think it's like the eternal doesn't necessarily mean unchanging or unchanging selfhood. You can see eternal as being eternal in a sense of outside of time and space. We're using a different type of language here.
Of Buddhahood.
You're not. I mean, you've got the three actions. And the three actions apply to conditioned existence. But one of them also applies to unconditioned, to enlightenment, and that is, there's no self-nature.
There is nothing which is not dependently arisen. The opponent's view is that the phenomenal world is non-empty, and hence that all things have an essence. For him, a Buddha arises independent of enlightenment, and vice versa. And also for one who was unenlightened and practicing the path could not achieve enlightenment. The Nagarjuna has shown here that rarefying either the conventional or the ultimate denies the existence of the thing it rarefies, and therefore makes all Buddhist doctrine and practice impossible. However, an understanding of the emptiness of emptiness makes complete sense of the phenomenal world and of emptiness itself as being nominally existent or conventionally existent and dependently arisen, but without essence, without inherent existence. So if emptiness had an essence, there could be no phenomenal world, because everything would be permanently empty and non-existent. It's really just said you can't fix anything, either phenomena or emptiness. Moreover, one could never perform right or wrong actions. If this were all non-empty, what could one do? That with an essence cannot be produced. The opponent's view is that nothing makes sense in terms of emptiness, but But here in the Guardian it makes clear that it's only in terms of emptiness that practice makes sense. Right and wrong action is about karma. If all were non-empty, how could there be action? From neither right or wrong action would the fruit arise. If the fruit arose from right or wrong actions, according to you, it wouldn't exist. If for you a fruit arose from right or wrong actions, then having arisen from right or wrong actions, how could that fruit be non-empty? So if from right or wrong action nothing would arise, but if it did, then according to the opponent's view, it wouldn't exist. Also, if a fruit did arise, how could it be non-empty? If there was a fruit, if a fruit arises, it has, it can't be empty.
In the very act of arising,
it can't not be empty. I mean,
yes,
sorry.
Yes, yes. The very act of something arising is pratichasamutpada unfolding, isn't it?
Yeah. And emptiness is pratichasamutpada. If dependent arising is denied, emptiness itself is rejected. This would contradict all of the worldly conventions. So, emptiness is dependent. Thus, if dependent arising is denied, as it is by the opponent, then there can't be conventional phenomenal world. The opponent reifies the convention. He gives it inherent existence. And when he does this, he precludes change. So if there's no change, there can be no progress. On the other hand, if they're empty, without essence, and conventionally real, practice and enlightenment are possible. Enlightenment is only possible if they're empty. If they arise in dependence and conditions. If emptiness itself is rejected, no action will be appropriate. There will be no action which did not begin, and there will be no agent without action. If there is essence, the whole world will be unarising, unceasing, and static. The entire phenomenal world would be immutable. So if everything had an essence, there would be no arising or ceasing. The phenomenal world would be static. Nothing could change. If it were not empty, then action would be without profit. The act of ending suffering and abandoning misery and defilement would not exist. So if the phenomenal world were not empty, then there could be no progress. There could be no action that would end suffering. As the opponent reifies the world, which an examination would be completely hopeless. On the other hand, if everything, including ourselves, is empty, then in the context of dependent arising, ethics, meditation, and wisdom become possible.
Is it just the way he's expressed it to say, if there is essence, compared to if it were not empty?
Yes.
Is that just it's the same thing, isn't it? It's just the same thing.
There's
nothing subtle about it.
Yeah. No. Whoever sees dependent arising also sees suffering and its arising and its cessation as well as the path. So he's saying that if you see dependent arising, you understand the Four Noble Truths. And you see that that's the path.
Yeah. This is a question that's rumbling through my mind about the significance of this material. I've often thought of this material as being a presentation of reality.
Mm.
What I'm starting to get at with this is to see it as a presentation of the path.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, it's like if you see this as true, it's not that you see enlightenment, but you see the path. In a way, you see the transformation process. Because I think I've always thought of it as, you know, this is how it is, rather than this is the way of seeing things that I engage my being with, become unified with, become part of, that does whatever it does.
Yeah, well, it is definitely that, and
yeah.
His examination of the Four Noble Truths might not be so clear in some of the other examinations, but in this particular, it is an exploration of the path.
Can I just ask a wee bit about Nagarjuna?
Uh-huh. He's known as the founder of the Mahayana. More or less, he's considered to be the founder of the Mahayana. He's certainly the founder of the Madhyamaka school, which is the sort of first school, as far as I understand it, in the long line of schools of Mahayana Buddhism. He's somewhere around the first century of the current era. I don't know very much else about him. His main work is actually this Rula Madhyamaka Karika, Fundamental Wisdom of the Buddha. Do you know anything more about him?
I don't think there's a lot known about Nagarjuna in
historically, there isn't
a lot. I mean, I can't remember. Do you remember? He's supposed to have got the teachings from the Nagas, isn't he? Do you remember the story?
I don't know why he did this. I don't know if it was because maybe it was in a dream. Do you know the story? Nagarjuna, the story is that Nagarjuna got into a boat and he rowed out into a lake. And this Naga princess emerged from the lake, and Naga is a snake, so she was a snake serpent princess, and she rose out of the lake carrying texts which she gave to Nagarjuna. She handed them to him, and you remember Prasad was saying that there's a piece of mythology that says the Buddha taught the perfection of wisdom, but it was a hidden teaching. So this was the Buddha's hidden teaching on the perfection of wisdom, which had been kept and trusted by the sea serpents. So there's a bit of symbolism there to do with depths, underneath the conscious mind and hidden down in the depths,
mm-hmm.
and then arising when the appropriate teacher appears in the world. So you get these fantastic paintings of Nagarjuna with a halo of snakes. It's like there's snakes coming out of his hair, like a sort of a bit like a gorgon.
He's a monk, isn't he?
Yes.
He's a monastic practitioner.
Yeah.
And we also have the letters to the king, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
So he's obviously, of his time, he's obviously well renowned and is in dialogue. So I mean, a lot of his work is quite philosophical in disposition, but you've also got some quite practical texts as well.
Interestingly, you're getting a bit of a flavour of the quality of mind, the quality of philosophical work that he developed, but he also wrote fantastic hymns of praise to Tara. So the emphasis on thought and investigation, philosophical inquiry is also also augmented and very strong devotional to Tara. So Tara is one of the earlier Bodhisattva figures who emerged, and he developed quite a bit of her worships the writing hymns of praise. So she's the she's the quintessence of compassion, compassion and action. Just a kind of interesting combination.
And treatise on ethics as well.
What a nice counter. I'll read you the sort of conclusion that a little bit about at the end. That Nagarjuna makes clear what is essential to the entire Madhyamaka doctrine, the emptiness of emptiness. As already pointed out, this amounts to the emptiness being dependently arisen with an identity which is only a verbal conventional designation. It is this that makes it empty, and in this way, in no way differs from conventional phenomena, which are no more than their parts. To see phenomena as being merely conventional is to see them as being empty, and that emptiness is their ultimate mode. On the one hand, they are conventionally existent, insofar as they are true in our everyday experience of them. We do, for instance, experience a table as being intrinsically identifiable and substantial. On the other hand, it is empty and non-existent. These are the two truths of Nagarjuna's doctrine, and they seem to be completely different, existence and non-existence. However, the entire doctrine is pointing to their deep identity. As we have seen, phenomena are dependently arisen, and since emptiness is empty, it also is dependently arisen. A phenomenon and its emptiness are not separate. They are both Triticcha Samvit Pada. And as the heart sutra said, form is empty, emptiness is form.
So, do you know what the timing is of the arising of the Heart Sutra relative to Nagarjuna?
The arising of the Heart, that the Nagarjuna came before the Heart Sutra, but the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines is, as far as I've gathered, from the 1st century BCE. But the Heart Sutra comes in somewhere about the 2nd or 3rd. About the 2nd or 3rd century, I think, of the current era. And Nagarjuna is somewhere, according to what I've read anyway, around the 1st century of the current era. So he comes after 8,000 lines, but before the Heart Sutra.
So do you think it's likely that he was responding to having read the
Well, it appears that the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras had come before Nagarjuna, so he was probably responding or developing from the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines.
There's a lovely story just in this business, which I rather like, from the Buddhism first coming to North America. They were starting up a debate. So they got the two, I think it was a Zen Buddhist and a Tibetan Buddhist, to debate this big Dharma debate. So they got them together in the room. And all there's big high pressure, and one of them whips an orange out of his robe and says, "What is this?" This Dharma debate. And the other guy leans to his instructor and says, "Did we not have oranges for this month?"
So that is emptiness, is Triticcha Samvit Pada.